You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On November 29, 2012, workers at several fast food chains in New York City, McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, walked off their jobs and went on strike for fairer pay. What followed was a chain of protests throughout the United States demanding a living wage. In a new book called The Fight for 15, The Right Wage for America, David Rolfe, the president of Local 775 of the Service Employees International Union, argues for a national $15 minimum wage. His book is published by The New Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Leonard.
When did you join the SEIU?
Oh, 25 years ago.
Were you always interested in labor rights or just got a job and wound up in a union?
No, I was interested in labor rights. You know, I grew up in a family who was middle class because of the American labor movement. My great-grandfather was the president of a distillery workers local in Cincinnati. My grandfather on my mother's side was born poor and became middle class because he joined the United Auto Workers when he was an industrial carpenter at a GM plant. So I grew up as a beneficiary of the power and economic strength that the American labor movement built in the middle of the 20th century. And when I couldn't decide whether to go to grad school or law school, I decided to spend a year organizing, and that was now many, many years ago, and never really wanted to do anything else.
Were New York City fast food workers the first to walk off their jobs and demand higher wages?
Yeah, it was a couple hundred workers in Brooklyn in November of 2012, and it was the first fast food strike in living memory in the United States. There had been some organizing in the late 70s, early 80s in the upper Midwest in the fast food sector, but it became really the spark that I'd say took the energy and enthusiasm and creativity of Occupy, but really married it with a set of very concrete demands for $15 in a union. And that became the spark that really gave rise to six other strikes over the course of the next 6 months, landing in Seattle in May of 2013, and then on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, 60 cities striking in August of that year.
No, it started with this hot and crusty store on the Upper East Side, which everybody said was going to go out of business, and it's still in business. But why $15? Isn't it an arbitrary number? Why not $12? Hillary Clinton has proposed that. Why not $20, $25? I would think it would be hard to live on less than $25 an hour for most people.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it was an ambitious, morally compelling demand that workers were willing to rally around. It wasn't cooked up in a laboratory. I mean, we can say accurately that if the minimum wage had inflated with the cost of living since 1968, its peak in real spending power, it would now be around $12 an hour. We could say that if it inflated with productivity, it would be closer to $22 an hour. And if it inflated with CEO pay, it would be closer to $30 an hour. But the reality is that the demand for $15 in a union was a bold, morally inspirational demand that workers felt inspired to walk off the job for.
Well, let's go now to the state of Washington.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the SeaTac area and what happened there?
Well, so SeaTac is the name of the small city surrounding the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. It's essentially six neighborhoods surrounding an airport. It's as if Astoria were its own city instead of being part of New York.
And named after two cities.
It's named after Seattle. It's really named after its own airport, which was the airport's established in the 50s. The city didn't incorporate until the 70s. And it's an inner ring suburb in decline economically. It's a huge port of entry for immigrants entering the country. It's got the majority of its residents are younger immigrants who are poor. The majority of its voters are older, white, middle-class homeowners who often, in many cases, held the aerospace and aviation jobs that were middle-class a generation ago. And SeaTac was the home of what became the nation's first successful $15 wage fight.
Now, were they inspired by what had happened in New York?
For sure. It was really workers who had this idea that workers at the subcontracted aviation companies, this alphabet soup of no-name brands that actually clean your cabins, put fuel in your jets, serve you food or prepare your food, handle your baggage. Those jobs were once held by airline workers making $60,000 a year with health care and a pension. today they're held by minimum wage workers working for subcontractors. And those workers were inspired by what happened in the strikes around the country and decided to demand $15 at SeaTac.
Did those jobs become de-unionized? Is Washington a right-to-work state?
No, Washington's not right-to-work. What happened is after the airline, and this is not only a Washington state problem, after the Airline Deregulation Act passed in 1978, as airline companies began competing directly on their routes, they looked at any way to cut costs. And increasingly, they maintained the direct customer-facing jobs as high-wage union jobs that were in-house, but they subcontracted out everything else. So the baggage handler who used to work for United Airlines or Alaska Airlines now may work for a company called Bags or a company called Menzies or a company called DGS, making essentially the minimum wage without benefits.
And what about your union, the SEIU? Did you represent any of the airport workers?
SEIU Local 6, which is a property services local, the equivalent of what New Yorkers might recognize as 32BJ, represented the cleaners who clean the airport and are in the middle of organizing some of the other customer service and property services workers who serve the airlines directly. But in general, no, SEIU was not the dominant union at the airport.
So we have a situation where a generation earlier, these jobs included benefits and better wages.
That's right.
And now all of that had changed. Don't opponents of higher minimum wages argue that it's going to hurt small businesses, force layoffs, and prevent a lot of young people and immigrants from being able to enter the workforce?
That's exactly what opponents argue, and they've been wrong since 1937, when when Congress enacted the first federal minimum wage. They've actually been wrong longer than that. In 1913, when Congress was considering a law preventing children from having to work more than 8 hours a day, the head of the American Federation of Department Stores testified that all the department stores would go out of business if children weren't allowed to work more than 8 hours a day. Now, 100 years later, 103 years later, some department stores may go out of business, but it's more likely because of Amazon than it is because children were prohibited from working long hours in the 1910s.
My guest is David Rolfe, who's written a book called The Fight for 15, The Right Wage for Working America. Can you talk about the Good Jobs campaign?
At SeaTac?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, SeaTac, the SeaTac Committee for Good Jobs was the worker and community organization that was formed, after workers had frankly gotten tired of 3 years of asking for union representation and being told to go pound sand by the big airline companies. So they qualified a ballot measure. And in about half of U.S. states, ballot measures are a way that citizens can petition to get a law written into the books.
But hadn't they first tried to unionize and failed?
Yeah, that's right. Under the Railway Labor Act, the 1919 law that applies to airport workers, in order for some of these workers to get a union, they would have had to convince not only a majority of their coworkers at SeaTac, but a majority of their coworkers from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon, from Honolulu to Miami to form a union together. It's essentially a union prevention law. And so what workers did, and they were very clever about this, was essentially write the equivalent of a union contract into the city code with not just $15 wages, but paid sick leave, guarantees of full-time hours, anti-retaliation provisions, provisions that hotel workers couldn't be forced to give their tips over to management. And so workers were really creative and say, well, okay, if it's going to take us a little bit longer to get a union than we wanted, we're going to, in the meantime, force the boss to give us a living wage.
So this was going to be voted on,
yeah,
Proposition 1.
That's right. SeaTac Prop 1 in 2013 was on the ballot, and essentially the citizens of SeaTac got to vote whether there'd be $15.
Now, similar attempts have generally been voted down. There's usually most of the money for ads, for example, comes from the opposition.
Yeah, that's right.
What happened here?
Workers and their supporters, the union movement, the faith community, a bunch of immigrant rights communities knocked on door. There were only about 10,000. At the start of the campaign, there were only about 10,000 registered voters. The first thing we did was expand the electorate, registered a couple thousand more people to vote. The second thing we did
You're lucky you're in Washington, not North Carolina.
That's exactly right. So we expanded the list of registered voters. We registered young people, people of color, immigrants, and then we knocked on 10,000 doors 40,000 times. We treated it like a union organizing campaign and wouldn't count someone as a yes vote until we saw a sign go up in their yard or a sticker on their window.
But you also have to convince business owners that the proposition would help their business,
That's
not
right.
hurt it.
Yeah, and this
How'd
is,
you do that?
Well, you know, this was what we didn't do was concede the job killer debate to the right wing. And some businesses said this is going to hurt us, but we identified businesses that actually understood it was going to help them. A guy named Don Liberty runs a sports bar in the south end of SeaTac, and he became the most public spokesperson for Prop 1 by saying that, you know what, if airport workers get off shift and they actually have money in their pockets, they're going to come in, they're going to have a beer, they're going to have a burger, they're going to play a video game, they're going to watch the baseball game on my TVs, and that's going to make me money. It was a middle-out argument instead of a trickle-down argument.
Now, that was an argument that Henry Ford used way back when.
That's correct.
When he decided to pay his auto workers more than his competitors were paying. He said, if they have enough money, they're going to buy one of my cars.
That's right.
Now, and everybody says that was brilliant. Why has that idea not had more life to it?
Well, I think that the shareholder revolutions of the 80s and a bunch of changes that the SEC and the IRS ultimately convinced CEOs that it made more sense for them to spend 90% of their revenue manipulating their share price to get bonuses rather than doing long-term investment in the productivity of the company. And so, you know, I've had this debate with the CEO of a major air carrier, and I said, you know,
but Alaska Airlines.
I said, you know, Brad, why wouldn't it be cool if the people who put fuel in your jets could someday afford to buy a ticket on one of them?
Mm. And what did he say?
Oh, he pointed to some sort of balance sheet and talked about labor costs and competition.
Was it an uphill battle initially?
Oh yeah, you know, this is now the new normal. Now 18 million Americans are benefiting from the fight for 15 directly through higher minimum wage laws passed in their states or their cities. You know, we should remember that as recently as late 2012, this was considered crazy. And governors and senators and people in the administration all thought that, that just can't be done. I was on the phone yesterday with a leading economist who advises Democratic elected officials. And we had this conversation about how, well, you know, it just the fact that it had never been done before meant that there was no evidence that it would succeed. And the fact that there was no evidence meant even relatively progressive and liberal economists, you know, were hesitant and a little bit afraid to speak out for it.
And then others in the city were inspired by what happened here. We'll take a little break and we'll come back and talk about Carolyn DeRosa.
Yeah.
And some of the other things that have happened in Seattle and why Seattle now is suffering and its businesses are all falling apart. My guest is David Rolfe, who's written The Fight for 15, The Right Wage for a Working America. It's published by the New Press. We are back with David Rolfe, who is the president of Local 775 of the Service Employees International Union in Seattle. We're talking about his book, The Fight for 15, The Right Wage for America, which is published by the New Press. On May 29th, 2013, a 21-year-old named Carolyn DeRosa walked off her night shift at Taco Bell in Seattle. What led her to walk out that night?
Well, you know, we had been organizing fast food workers in Seattle as, you know, we were around the country. For a demand for $15 in a union, and this idea that it's not okay to live in poverty, and that if you work for a living, that you really ought to be able to support yourself and not have to, like Carolyn did, walk miles and miles home down a dangerous street at 3 a.m. Because the buses had stopped running and she couldn't afford a car. So when Carolyn walked off the job,
What was she being paid?
The Washington State minimum wage, which I think that year was $9.18.
That's more than some places.
It's more than some places, yeah. The federal minimum wage at the time was $7.25. But Seattle's an expensive city, and Carolyn would... We have this avenue called Aurora Avenue. It's dangerous. It's parts of it have seedy motels and drug activity and prostitution, and Carolyn would have to walk down Aurora Avenue home at 3 a.m., often after having been told to clock out at 1, but stay and clean the kitchen unpaid until 3.
So was this a one person doing this, or did others follow?
The next day, thousands of Seattle fast food workers walked off the job in a coordinated set of actions. Some of it was predictable. Some of it happened spontaneously. But it was one of the first six strikes in the country for fast food workers. Some gas station workers also walked off. And it really captivated the attention of the public in Seattle. It was on every TV station, every radio station. And the demand was strike poverty.
Well, franchises present a certain kind of a problem for people who argue for a $15 minimum wage. If you go to the Taco Bell main headquarters or McDonald's or whatever, they say, well, we don't really own these stores. They're owned by franchisers, and they make their own arrangements in their own locations.
Let's talk about McDonald's for a second. McDonald's, Ray Kroc, brilliant businessman, borrowed a business concept from the sewing machine industry called franchising, and imported it into fast food. He was a blender salesman who bought the marketing rights to his largest customer, the McDonald's Brothers hamburger stand in San Bernardino.
He sold them malted machines.
Yeah, that's right. And he then created this business model that centralized profit, decentralized risk, and assigned workers to permanent poverty. And, you know, it's technically true that McDonald's doesn't employ many of the direct employees of McDonald's franchises. What they do is they tell the franchises, put $250,000 of your nest egg to buy this franchise, then send us 20% off the top. Here's your menu. Here's your pricing. Here are your supply chains. By the way, you have to buy your workers' comp insurance from the corporate center. They dictate everything except wages. And then in order to make any money at all, the franchises are left paying next to nothing. So the franchises get a pretty bad deal. The workers get a totally raw deal. And the shareholders and the CEOs laugh all the way to the bank.
Don't fast food employers hire their workers on part-time basis?
Of course. Well, especially since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Now, you know, in the book, The Fight for 15, I quote an Arby's worker who laughs and says, well, of course I only work 29.75 hours a week, because if I worked 30 hours a week, my employer would have to pay me, have to, you know, enroll me in a health plan.
Is that something that the federal government has to adjust?
Well, ultimately, I think that we should move toward a system of prorated, portable, and universal benefits rather than this binary system based on hours. So, yeah. In the meantime, though, in cities like Seattle, we're working on legislation to make fair scheduling the law.
Now, a listener, Corgi, writes on our show page, I'm a little baffled how it is that the same minimum wage can be proposed for places like New York City and Seattle as for Iowa, when the cost of living in New York must be about five times what it is in small town USA.
Well, you know, it's a great point. You know, the U.S. has had one federal minimum wage since 1937. We've had one rate of payment into Social Security. How much your Medicare or Social Security benefits are the same, regardless whether you live in rural eastern Tennessee or in downtown San Francisco. So it's a characteristic of American labor standards that we generally have one federal floor. Truth be told, in Seattle, it costs a little bit over $90,000 a year to live a comfortable life. And even a self-sufficiency standard would be in the $18 range, which our inflation-adjusted wage won't reach until about 2025.
And New York is even more expensive.
New York is even more. San Francisco
is even more expensive than New York.
That's right. And Honolulu more than San Francisco and so forth,
Now, all of this happened. The fast food strikes occurred right before the election. So
Seattle,
did this become a big political thing in Seattle?
Yeah. I don't think anyone running for mayor or running for city council who threw their hat in the ring in late 2012 or early 2013 expected that the election was going to become a referendum on living wages, but that's exactly what happened.
And what happened with the various candidates? Were they forced to take positions?
Oh, yeah. Low-wage workers held their own televised town hall debate that all the major mayoral candidates participated in June of 2013. And the first question was, show us what your household budget would be if you made the state minimum wage. And every candidate had to admit it was a completely unworkable proposition. So as the campaign went on, as strikes and boycotts and sit-ins and civil disobedience were all happening during that hot summer in the fast food industry, and with the SeaTac election happening right down the road, 15 miles south.
Were the two campaigns coordinated?
They were. Yeah, ultimately it was the same group of organizational leaders, union leaders, faith leaders, social justice and anti-poverty leaders working together on both campaigns.
And troublemakers like you.
Yeah, union leaders like me. Yeah. So what we ended up with was really a mayoral race where the two candidates seemed to be at times in a bidding war over how high to raise the minimum wage. And the single issue that really drove the election in 2013 in Seattle was, were you for $15 or not?
And Ed Murray endorsed the $15 yes. living wage and ultimately won the election.
That's exactly right.
Now, in the debates between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, it came down to some degree to whether it should be $12 nationally or $15 nationally. Yep. She made the point that some areas are less expensive than others, and Bernie Sanders made the point that even in the poorest areas, $15 is
That's right.
Minimal.
Yeah.
So should we have an adjustable? And what is an acceptable bottom?
Well, you know, I mean, I make the case that 15 is the least acceptable bottom. You know, we could have a debate about that, I suppose. You know, New York and Oregon are both looking at sort of some sort of geographic banding propositions where urban areas go at a higher, faster rate and rural areas stay behind. Ultimately, I think that's not going to work out very well for the rural areas. It may even accelerate depopulation as people move into urban areas looking for higher wages.
After the election, weren't you involved in negotiating with the businesses and labor and community partners and politicians on how to best implement the raise?
The mayor of Seattle appointed a 24-person stakeholder committee to negotiate, to spend 4 months negotiating the parameters and policies around $15. And I was there were two co-chairs. I was the labor co-chair, a guy named Howard Wright, who runs an investment firm that invests in a large number of hospitality-related businesses, famously the Space Needle and the Sheraton Hotel, was the business co-chair. And we spent 4 months, often late at night, through our weekends and into the early mornings, at a labor business community stakeholder table, figuring out the details.
I'm speaking with David Rolf, R-O-L-F. His book, The Fight for $15, the Right Wage for a Working America. It is published by the New Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What are the impacts of the increasing the minimum wage on Seattle's people, its economy and businesses? It's been a couple of years now.
Yeah.
Can we say we can see tangible results?
So, first of all, workers have more money. You know, right,
Have businesses gone out of business?
Well, I'm sure some businesses have gone out of business, but overall, there's no evidence that any businesses have gone out of business because of the minimum wage increase.
Do we know about job growth?
You know, Washington State has the fastest growing economy in the country, the highest rate of GDP growth. The biggest problem we have in Seattle is that you can't rent a construction crane because there's a waiting list, and there are just not enough housing units to house all the people who want to live there.
One of the issues with food workers is tipping.
Yes.
Now, tipped workers get much less than even the minimum wage.
Yes. The federal minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13 an hour. It has not gone up since George H.W. Bush was president. And in about half of U.S. states, that's actually the wage they get paid. Washington State eliminated the tip credit in 1988 via ballot measure.
And so the minimum wage applies?
The minimum wage applies. The full minimum wage applies to tipped workers in Washington State. Interestingly, the restaurant, you know, someone said to me from Washington, D.C., you know, every time I come to your city, I pack my lunch because I expect there to be no restaurants there. In fact, Seattle has the second highest per capita number of restaurants in the U.S. behind only San Francisco that also has a high city minimum wage.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about us moving into a gig economy.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the alternative?
Well, I think, you know, the Labor Department hasn't actually studied this since 2005, which might as well be, you know, 1492 at this point in terms of the rapid changes in technology and the economy.
Well, that's before Uber, Airbnb,
exactly.
TaskRabbit.
That's right.
Who knows what else?
Yeah. So next year, the Labor Department's funded again to do a comprehensive study of the ways we work and what percentage of us are working full-time, part-time, on-demand, shift work, day labor, you know, all the different ways of working. But here's the point I make in my book, The Fight for 15, is that, you know, it didn't take smartphones to create alternative forms of work. You know, Ray Kroc founded McDonald's 4 years after the Treaty of Detroit was signed, when American companies began to take responsibility for pension, health care, and cost of living adjustments. And in the 60s, we had a company called then Kelly Girl that advertised that your company could hire a temp who would never get sick, never, you know, chip a tooth, never have a headache on your dime. And then in the 70s, we saw the beginning of contracting out and domestic outsourcing, followed by global outsourcing in the 1980s and 90s. So this rush to shed responsibilities for the embedded costs of employment has actually been going on for as long as America has privatized our social contract onto employers.
How has outsourcing influenced the economy of Seattle? After all, Boeing is a major employer, and isn't it building an awful lot of its planes outside of Seattle now?
You know, Boeing continues to be a major Seattle employer as it also expands into South Carolina and into countries around the globe where it does business. You know,
and saves money.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think that at the end of the day, what can be things that can be done by robots will be done by robots. Things that can be outsourced will be outsourced. Ron Unz, the conservative Silicon Valley billionaire who ran against California Governor Pete Wilson from the right in the 1994 primary, has said, you know what, higher minimum wages are actually conservative rocket fuel. The stuff that can be offshored will be offshored no matter what. The stuff that can be technologized will be technologized no matter what. But if workers are getting high wages, it creates more businesses for more customers for business. It lessens dependency on social welfare programs, and it increases tax collection without raising marginal tax rates.
Now, what about your union? You're the vice president of SEIU.
One of them, I'm one of the vice presidents,
The local there. Who do you represent?
I'm the president of SEIU 775, the founder and president.
You're a vice president of
The international union, yeah.
International?
It's called international because it reflects U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico. It's a term of art in the American labor movement. But we represent 45,000 home care and nursing home workers in Washington State and Montana.
Mm-hmm. And some unions wind up representing people who don't necessarily sound like they should be in the union. Teamsters represent all sorts of people who don't drive trucks. Is that apply here as well?
My local is an industry-specific local in the long-term care sector of the health industry. So no, we aren't a department store union or a general workers union. But that doesn't mean we don't spend our resources and the power we're lucky enough to have built delivering for all workers. Because I think it's a mistake for unions to think about their primary role as some sort of talent manager or talent agent trying to get the best deal just for their members. Americans will learn to love the labor movement again only when we speak for the aspirations of all workers, not just those who happen to be lucky enough to have a union.
Are you surprised when people vote against having a union, despite what you see as it being in their best interest?
I think given the way the deck is stacked against American workers and American unions, it's more surprising that anyone votes for a union at all. I mean, only in America is union. I mean, why is having a collective bargaining considered an optional right? I don't have to organize all my neighbors to exercise the right of free speech. I don't have to hold a meeting to exercise the right to carry arms. I don't have to have a government-supervised election to win the right to trial by jury, but the right to collective bargaining is something that you have to go through an arduous, psychologically torturous 6-week to 6-month to 6-year process to win. So the fact that there are any workers choosing a union at all, given the way the deck is stacked against them, is itself, I think, a testament to the courage of workers who stand up to their employers.
Do you see this as a big issue in the coming presidential election?
The minimum wage is a huge issue, and we're going to have, it looks like, a clear choice between a candidate who has been for every actual $15 campaign that's actually been run and a candidate who says that wages are too high.
You're talking about the Democrat.
Hillary versus Donald Trump,
mm-hmm. David Rolfe, his book, the fight for $15, the right wage for a working America. It's published by the New Press. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me.